McKinnon joins us right now from the greatest television show ever done about politics in America. And I don't think I'm overstating it. And I could just point to this. Every time I turn the TV on any of the 24-hour news channels for the last 5 days, Mark McKinnon, I saw you. You and your cowboy hat walking next to whoever the biggest story of the day was in Washington, including before those 30 Republican lawmakers storming the Bastille.
Yeah. And 13 of those Republicans are on committees where they are actually allowed into the hearing.
So why did they tell you they were doing it?
Well, they, you know, they're frustrated. The Republicans are really frustrated because they're losing the facts war and they're losing the message war. And when you don't have, the facts fight the process. And so they ramped up this whole argument about this closed hearings idea, which of course was written under, the rules were written by Republicans, and it's the same rules they had for the Benghazi hearings. But you know, it's for the public at large, that's kind of a complicated stuff. So it sounds reasonable for them to say, why are they holding these hearings in private? Why can't we hear? What are they hiding? Well, they're doing it for a reason. They're doing it because it's a deposition and not a hearing. And they don't want witnesses to infect other witnesses by hearing each other's testimony and changing their story. So, and they're going to release the transcripts later to everybody, and then they're going to have public hearings. So it's much ado about not much, but I think it really just reflects a greater frustration. You know, starting at the White House, I mean, the White House is kind of beating up a lot of these Republicans saying, get out there and do something. And so, you know, Matt Gaetz, who we see a lot out there, who's kind of the tip of the spear for Trump, was out leading that charge, and then he had a bunch of Republican senators over for lunch. And so I think really it's more an expression of frustration than anything, because we took a real deep dive on our show this week on what we call the deep state, which, as you know, is kind of the entrenched permanent bureaucracy, and you know what that is and how does it manifest itself. And but one of the ways it manifests itself, we're seeing this week, is that it's striking back, that these career diplomats are coming to the Hill and despite being warned not to by the president, they're testifying. And so from all we hear anyway at this point, these are some pretty credible witnesses, particularly this Bill Taylor guy, who was, despite being called, you know, a partisan radical by the White House, he was appointed by my old boss, George W. Bush, and rehired, brought back in by Mike Pompeo, President Trump's Secretary of State. And he's a Vietnam War vet, so not a typical radical that you'd expect. But I also understand, as not just Republicans, but as part of the elected team going into government, what that's like, because you encounter a lot of people who've been there for a long time, who are going to be there after you, who think they know a lot more than you do. And in my case, they did. But, you know, you have this friction between the elected people coming in and the people who are there permanently. And it's not new to Trump, although he's certainly refining it to a new level.
No bigger an anti-big state warrior than John Bolton is in negotiations to now sit down and testify. I have long believed the theory that John Bolton is behind a lot of the trouble the president has found himself in concerning Ukraine, especially anything that has popped since Bolton left in early September.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's no better, smarter, bureaucratic infighter than John Bolton. So, you know, he's great to have on your side, but man, you do not want him against you. And, you know, I thought the second he walked out the door, he was swimming like a big white shark around the White House. So I think it's going to be fascinating to hear him testify, because you know he's got a mighty big chip on his shoulder. And we already know from conversations we've had that he had a lot of concern about what was going on with Rudy Giuliani and Mick Mulvaney and this whole Ukrainian thing.
The irony is not lost here that John Bolton and a number of other conservatives have been behind a movement to get a guy just like Donald Trump into the White House, a populist, a guy who wants to stand up for conservative judges and conservative economic policy. Well, that's kind of out the window. But now that they've got their guy and he's not playing by their rules, they want to take him out.
Well, yes, you're exactly right. And you know, the problem for Bolton and others is that there's no, they at least they have an ideology and, you know, some coherence to what they believe. And Trump just, you know, he said, we're going to get people out of here and out of there, and not really acknowledging or recognizing the complicated nature of those alliances and the historical nature of them. But just saying, I said, I'm going to get them out. I'm getting them out. And whether or not that, you know, but Bolton's point and others are making the point that, you know, by by precipitously getting out, you're just creating a greater problem down the line. But Trump just hits what's right in front of him. And a lot of his followers and supporters out there are saying, great, we got out.
And another chapter opened in the last day. The Department of Justice says they are going to make criminal the investigation into the 2016 campaign, which means that they could subpoena Strzok or Page or maybe even Mueller. Where do you think it goes from here?
Well, if you kind of back away from this, I mean, you just have to say, Mr. President, you didn't lose this election. You won. And it's not very difficult, and most people recognize that a big part of the reason that you won is because the FBI and James Comey lit up Hillary Clinton on her emails and everything else at very inopportune times during the campaign. So, listen, we could have tons of investigations and maybe unearth some suspicious activity on the part of bureaucratic professionals expressing some sort of political intent. But it's just as easy to argue, or easier to say, that they hurt Hillary Clinton than they hurt Donald Trump. And the point is, you won. And it's 4 years later. I don't think a lot of people, other than the guy sitting at 6800 Pennsylvania, care about Peter Strzok or Hillary Clinton or any of this stuff from 4 years ago. We're worried about, you know, the future. Let's move on. By the way, I think this whole thing could backfire. And I just read an interesting article that it's too complicated for me to try and explain it. You would get it more quickly than I would. But maybe it's kind of a double reverse from Barr. Like, he's just doing it to appease the president. But this thing could maybe, you know, kind of fizzle badly in a way that kind of bites back.
Oh, I totally see this. If the Department of Justice wants to make this a federal case, which they just did, the rules of evidence would be in play, and then maybe you have to call Peter Strzok and Lisa Page up to testify publicly, or Robert Mueller up to testify publicly, and then he has to answer questions that he was reticent to answer in front of Congress. He won't have that luxury during a criminal investigation, and that could counter the White House's narrative that there's nothing to see here, he's totally exonerated.
Exactly right. So, you know, I think it's just going to be more affirmation for the American public at large that this is all partisanship, and they're really not doing the public business. And they were just, you know, whether you're Democrat or Republican, Washington, please just move on.
So back to the Democrats. New polls came out. One shows Biden way ahead of Warren. The other one shows Warren neck and neck with Biden. Has anything changed in the last week?
Not much, although there's, you know, more than one poll now in Iowa that shows Pete Buttigieg having moved into third place above Bernie Sanders. And I think that's significant because, as you know, the story out of Iowa is not going to be necessarily who wins. It's going to be who kind of upset the conventional wisdom and what's the surprise story. And it's not necessarily who runs first or second, but you know, Pete Buttigieg runs third in Iowa. I could argue that, you know, with say, Warren and Biden running first and second, arguably Buttigieg is going to get most of the coverage out of that because he's the unexpected factor there. And he's very much, I think, a natural candidate for New Hampshire. So he could blow into New Hampshire as kind of, you know, the comeback or the come out of nowhere kid. And that, you know, I think that people, even though Biden is, you know, maintaining some buoyancy, he's not adding to his vote totals anywhere, really. And it just seems so vulnerable. And I think Buttigieg, maybe Klobuchar, although she doesn't have nearly the war chest that Pete Buttigieg does. So, listen, Bernie's had a good couple of weeks. He had the good debate, had the AOC endorsement, had lots of money. So he's sticking around. Warren is in solid shape. Biden, you know, is got cracks, but he's still up there. So, yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental nature of the race is about the same, but Iowa's 100 days from now, and the key is going to be what happens there. And I think you could see a Buttigieg, Klobuchar, a Booker kind of thing breaking into that top tier, which could make it a story and maybe change the equation.
Is Biden in trouble with fundraising?
Well, yeah, big time. He's got $9 million in the bank as opposed to, I think, 24 and 30 million for Warren and Sanders. And not a lot of prospects to improve that because he's kind of soaked all the big donor money that he can. He's not a small donor fundraiser, and Sanders and Warren and Buttigieg all are. So not only does he not have a lot of money, he doesn't have prospects to raise a lot more either. So that's why he just sort of greenlit something he said he wouldn't do, which is to allow a super PAC to work on his behalf.
Really is interesting to watch the Democrats start to eat each other. right? They're going after Buttigieg now for stuff that happened in South Bend, Indiana with the police force. He clearly does still have a deficit with African-American voters. And as you just mentioned, you go out of Iowa, you go into New Hampshire, but then you go right into South Carolina. In the South Carolina Democratic primary, it's really driven by the African-American churches. And you just see Buttigieg not really tracking there.
Well, yeah, and as you know, Ro, there's been a sort of historical concern, or, you know, I don't know how you characterize it, in the African-American community about gay issues.
Yeah.
You know, they're not quite as quick to embrace.
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing. I noticed, and I think it was at the rally, you may have been at last week in Dallas, where he put a number of African-Americans in back of him, you know, in the crowd.
Yeah, I was there.
And it does seem like it's a bit of a strategy for the Trump campaign to say, hey, working class black men, I'm with you.
Sure. And he's got a great economic message to talk about how they're doing better than they ever historically have in terms of employment and wages. So he's got a strong argument there. The other component of that argument that I think is interesting is, like, oh, Elizabeth Warren can't win South Carolina. And my view about that is she's going to win it by winning Iowa and New Hampshire, just like all voters everywhere. Momentum and winning means something. And if somebody... I experienced it with George W. Bush. We were up in South Carolina. And this is obviously a Republican primary, so it doesn't relate to African-American voters, but it does to momentum generally and what happens with all voters, which is we were up 18 points in South Carolina the day before New Hampshire. We lost New Hampshire. And the next day in South Carolina, we were down 18 points. That was a swing of 36 points in 48 hours.
Here's the one thing we know for sure. A lot's going to change between now and February 3rd, the night of the first caucus.
Let's also remember that 100 days out in Iowa in 76, Jimmy Carter was in 10th place, and John Kerry was sitting at about the same place. So a lot can happen in 100 days.
Mark McKinnon, he is from the circus. See it Sunday night on Showtime. Do not miss it. Best half hour. If you don't have Showtime, buy Showtime or steal your grandmother's password. Either way, you're in.
Thanks,
MK.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
See ya.
Lauren Lapka's got the WGN traffic right now, and it's a mess.